to the L. Barrio, you know we got flow. East Harlem, home of the Vogue, the show. Listen, podcast dishing, easy going. On the show where the hot air's always blowing. Downloading, never miss an episode. Keep it real, always serve it Alamo. New York, New York, if you can make it here, you know the rest, you can make it anywhere.
This is episode 86 of the Brad Bogner Show. Our guest today is Kevin Gutzman, author of several books, including most recently James Madison and The Making of America. Kevin, thanks for being on the show today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So, you know, obviously with America, founding fathers, we think of Washington, Adams, Jefferson immediately. Madison's kind of in the background, you know. He's sort of like that country you memorize for a geography quiz and never thought of it again. And this book did a kind of a great job dispelling that myth and talking about how important he was, not only in shaping America, but how many of his legislative accomplishments were quite impressive.
Founding the Jeffersonian Republican Party, Thomas Jefferson. But I would argue that Madison was probably the second most important of these people. And that's because he was the fellow who put the principles of the Revolution on paper. So ultimately, for example, the principle of religious freedom that we're used to as one of our central commitments in America was formulated by Madison and made into law, more importantly, by Madison.
And that's one of the earliest achievements he has, and you call it one of his best, is that Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. As you know, Virginia's discussing whether or not to have a religion, Madison was very insistent that there are no officially sanctioned religion.
That's right. Well, Madison had seen at an early age, when he went off to college at Princeton in New Jersey, how religious freedom worked. And when he got back to Virginia from New Jersey, he saw that in Virginia, the Protestant Episcopal establishment was persecuting Baptists. He thought this was shameful, and it made him think about not only the way that religion ought to be related to government, but the way that different interest groups could league together to prevent government from oppressing any of them. So he not only gained the insight that government and religion ought not to be married, but that it was a good thing to have a multiplicity of people of different backgrounds, whether religious, ethnic, economic, geographic, because the more diversity you had, the less likely it was that any one group was going to be able to dominate and thereby oppress all the others.
So we get to a point where, you know, Madison, among others, is very disappointed with the Articles of Confederation. He finds it very ineffective. He helps coordinate the Philadelphia Convention, where they hope to get a new constitution in play.
Well, some people hoped for that. Madison hoped for that. Others thought that as Congress had instructed the states and as the states had instructed their delegates, what was going to happen in Philadelphia was that proposals were going to be made for amending the Articles of Confederation. Madison fell on the nationalist end of the spectrum. He wanted to create an entirely new government with power independent of the state governments. And while the kind of stock description of the Philadelphia Convention is that Madison wrote a national constitution and that was adopted, what really happened was that Madison wrote a national constitution, that is what's called the Virginia Plan, and the Philadelphia Convention essentially rejected it. Most of its chief features are not parts of the federal constitution that came out of the Philadelphia Convention.
So he comes in there. I feel like one of the big things for Madison coming in there was that he wanted population apportionment. You know, he comes from Virginia. It's the biggest state in the Union. He felt like the bigger states should have the most amount of votes, most amount of representatives in the Congress. And that was sort of something he didn't want to budge on.
That's right. He didn't want to budge on it. And actually, there were several, as I said, there were several national elements of his Virginia plan that he thought were essential, but that ultimately were rejected by the Philadelphia Convention. So if Madison had had his way, there would have been a bicameral legislature. Each house would have been apportioned by population. The lower house would have been elected by the people, and the upper house would have been elected by the lower house. But what came out of the convention instead was a bicameral legislature in which The lower house was apportioned by population, but in the upper house, each state was equal, as had been true under the Confederation, and then state legislators, not the people at large, were going to choose the members of the upper house. So this was entirely unlike what Madison hoped for. In fact, amounted to continuing the same kind of arrangement that he said was destroying the country. He was very unhappy with it. And that's just one of several such proposals. He argued strenuously against state equality in the Senate, and ultimately people from small states told him, look, either you can agree that we're going to be equal in the Senate, or this convention is going to break up without us agreeing to anything. And ultimately the convention did what those small state delegates had insisted on, despite Madison's extreme misgivings about it.
And what was interesting is, like you said, there was so much disagreement amongst all these issues, but ultimately a lot of people didn't necessarily have an idea, and that's where Madison was able to use his, you know, expertise and, you know, manipulation and oratory skills to just kind of say, hey, look, I've got a plan. You guys don't have a plan, so my plan is better than nothing. And that ultimately ended up working for him.
You mean in Philadelphia or during the ratification
process? Philadelphia, specifically in this case, yeah.
Well, in Philadelphia, as I said, the chief components of his proposal were rejected. So, for example, not only did he want the Congress to be structured the way I just described, but he also wanted Congress to have essentially an unlimited legislative power. What came out of the convention instead was that Congress would have a few powers that were enumerated in Article 1, Section 8. That was the opposite of what Madison wanted. Besides that, he wanted Congress to have a power to veto any state bill, any state law. And the Philadelphia Convention rejected this. Madison insisted it was essential. And even after the Philadelphia Convention ended, he wrote to Thomas Jefferson and said, essentially, this new government, even if it's ratified, will only last a few years because it doesn't have this essential element of a federal veto over state laws. So it's not that Madison had a proposal and other people ultimately accepted it. Instead, what happened was that they more or less rejected it.
So they end up, you know, ratifying the Constitution as in its current form in the Philadelphia Convention, and, you know, all the states are deciding whether or not to ratify it. He ends up working with Alexander Hamilton, a New York Federalist, to, you know, write these Federalist Papers, anonymous things, kind of discussing why the Constitution should be ratified. Now, do you think that was just a situation where he was so unhappy with the Articles of Confederation that he would work with the Constitution, even if he had a lot of misgivings, or is it just something where he thought it was better than nothing, or?
Well, those are both the same, right? He thought that this was a change from the Articles, and it was better than no change from the Articles. So he wanted there to be a central government with an executive branch, and of course the Articles didn't provide that, and this new government would have an executive branch. He thought there should be a central government with a judiciary under the old Constitution, the Articles of Confederation. There was no such thing, and now there would be, and so on. But the point is that these elements of the federal Constitution, even if Madison had not participated in drafting the Constitution, likely would have still been present. And we have other people in the Philadelphia Convention, Charles Pinckney, for example, from South Carolina, proposed a similar outline at the very beginning of the convention. And, you know, we shouldn't be surprised by that, because not only did the British government have a bicameral legislature and executive and judges, but so did every state. So the point is that Madison's influence over the Philadelphia Convention, I think, has been wildly exaggerated. At one point, in summarizing his experience in the convention, I say in James Madison and the Making of America that far from being the father of the Constitution, he's more like an unhappy witness at its C-section birth. Right there, there he is watching it, and, well, this wasn't what I wanted, but as I say, it's better than nothing. It's some change in the direction of having the central government have independent authority, even if it's not very much change in that direction.
One of the specific Federalist Papers you were particularly impressed with was Federalist Paper number 10. If you could just kind of go through a little of that with us, what it was that you liked about it and its impact, I guess, at that time.
Well, of course, there's nothing original with me in being impressed with Federalist Number 10. I think what the book says that's perhaps different, what the book does with Federalist 10 that's perhaps different from what your listeners have seen before, is that it shows that Madison's thinking about interest groups or factions small groups in the population was spurred by his consideration of the relationship among religious minorities back when he was a teenager in his early 20s. That's when he had been thinking about persecution of Baptists in Virginia and decided, you know, if we had more of religious heterogeneity in this state and in every state, we'd be far less likely to have people being whipped and jailed and fined and having snakes thrown at them and beehives thrown into their churches and that kind of thing, as was going on in Virginia. So he stood Montesquieu's dictum that you could only have Republican government in a small area on his head. He said, really, over a long period of time, you can only have a Republican government in a large area, because it's in a large area that you're going to be sure that you're not going to have a permanent majority oppressing a minority the way they had had, say, in Connecticut with the Congregationalists persecuting dissenters, or in Virginia with the Episcopalians persecuting dissenters, and so on.
I thought it was interesting, too, because you mentioned how, well, despite the fact that the Federalist Papers are anonymous, this was kind of a common approach at the time, even when he wrote an anonymous op-ed for the approval of Virginia's statute for religious freedom and not having a sanctioned religion. That was kind of a common tactic. It wasn't necessarily some spineless way to avoid taking responsibility. They didn't necessarily want people to be swayed by a big name.
Well, actually, there was a kind of ethic against signing your name to, as you say, an op-ed or an editorial or even a pamphlet in those days. The idea was that if you said, I, James Madison, think X, Y, and Z, people would have the impression that you were trying to tell them, look, I'm more important than you, and so you should agree with this. In fact, we have a couple of cases where prominent people in Virginia signed their names and then got personally attacked in the papers for months on end. So it wasn't that Madison, Hamilton, Jay, in that case, were doing this, as you said, through some kind of innovative insight, but rather they were just kind of following the cultural pattern of submitting this kind of thing to the candid judgment of their fellow citizens without saying, oh, and you should agree to it because I'm John Jay, I've been the president of Congress, and you're not, so you definitely should buy my argument. The idea was that this allowed the argument to stand on its own merits.
Right, right. And see, then we eventually get to the Richmond Convention, where Virginia's deciding whether or not to ratify the Constitution, and Madison comes up with some of his old foes. Patrick Henry once said, give me liberty or give me death. And I feel like Madison might not have been opposed to the latter happening. They definitely butted heads almost their entire careers on many issues.
Well, I actually show elsewhere in the book that at one point, Jefferson and Madison, who were perpetually allies in Virginia politics, had come into loggerheads with Patrick Henry, and Jefferson got really frustrated, and finally he wrote to Madison, I guess the only thing we can do is pray for him to die. Because whenever the three of them disagreed, Henry always won. So it seemed very frustrating to Jefferson and Madison that Henry was always prone to get his way. In the Virginia Convention, what happened, the kind of stock version, just as the stock version of Philadelphia, is that Madison wrote the draft and the Philadelphia Convention adopted it, which is, as I explained, entirely inaccurate. So the stock version of the Virginia Ratification Convention is, there Madison was, and he made better arguments than Henry. Henry made a lot of histrionic arguments, and ultimately Madison's superior reasoning carried the day. But no, that's not what happened. What really happened was that Madison and his fellow Federalists, especially George Nicholas and Edmund Randolph, ended up having to say that the Constitution, if adopted, would only give the federal government a few powers. In fact, the way the governor, Edmund Randolph, put it was that under this new Constitution, Congress would only have the powers, and these were his words, expressly delegated. So the principle was that if you looked at the Constitution and found the power delegated to Congress, Congress could do that, but if you didn't, it couldn't. And as we know, this is going to be the central point in constitutional disputation all the way up to the 1860s, or arguably even all the way up to today. But Henry got his way from them because he made them concede that the Constitution was going to be read the way he would want a Constitution to be read. And at that point, very narrowly, the Virginians ratified it, again, on the insistence that in the first Congress, their congressmen were going to propose amendments amounting to a Bill of Rights. So it really was far more of a dialectical process than just Madison saying, well, here's my fabulous argument, adopt it, and people voting, yeah, that's a great argument.
Yeah. Now, there was a funny part, too, where, I mean, a lot of the political infighting and bickering felt the same then as it is today, but the one guy who just commanded everybody's respect was George Washington. There was one part where Henry, it sounded like he was almost criticizing Washington, and then he fights back, and then he's like, whoa, 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 I wasn't saying anything, negative against the general. So that's sort of that guy who just never has had to fight too much criticism, it seems like.
That's right. Basically, everybody admired him because he was just a world historic figure. It was so incredibly freakish that somebody had that kind of authority and willingly resigned it. Everybody recognized that Washington was the central figure in the Revolution and that his likely role under this new Constitution was going to be as the first president. And people did not lament that fact. What anti-federalists tended to say was what George Mason said, which was, you can't count on always having a Washington as president. You have to be worried about the structure of this government, not because Washington's dangerous, but because of what's going to come after him. So, you're right. Both sides accepted that Washington was a great man.
So Madison ultimately becomes the fourth president. It serves two terms. One of the biggest issues was the War of 1812 with the British. And obviously this is a situation where he kind of changed his mind on sort of how the military should be used by the end of his second term.
Well, the War of 1812 is the great low point of Madison's public career. He did a very inept job of conducting America's foreign policy, and he did a very inept job of leading the army. Ultimately, this is symbolized by the fact that the British marched across Maryland in 1814, went into effectively undefended Washington, D.C., and burned down the Capitol, burned down the White House, burned down all the government offices, including the Library of Congress. And, what had happened was that essentially a long-standing experiment by Madison and Jefferson to see whether government could be conducted without a substantial military force had proven to be a total failure. Economic coercion was a failure. Every initiative that Madison had undertaken as president and in foreign policy came down to the British burning down the Capitol and the White House. So ultimately, the Americans got out of the War of 1812 an agreement by the British to restore things to the way they had been before. In those days, they said the status quo ante, right? What do you get? Status quo ante. What does that mean? Well, we fought this long war, and we had our capital burned down, and we get nothing, and we're happy with that because the alternative would have been for America to lose a lot of territory. And the only reason that didn't happen was because the British decided it wasn't worth the effort.
They had the French, too, so I guess everybody was very busy with other things. And what was interesting was, so the War of 1812 and Madison, we always think of that infamous story about, Dolly Madison, his wife, thought to take down that famous George Washington painting in the White House before the British burned the city to the ground. We think of her as this, great lady for that. But you mentioned at the end, in James Madison's will, there was sort of the express understanding that eventually his slaves would become freed, similar to what Washington did. But his wife went ahead and sold them anyway. And so I guess she wasn't too interested in what James Madison had to say on that.
Well, it wasn't in his will, because as you say, Washington had provided in his will that his slaves would be free when Martha died. And as soon as he died, people realized, uh-oh, this means that Martha's living with a bunch of people who would really benefit by having her die immediately. So other people in the Virginia leadership did not copy Washington in that. But what Madison apparently did was to talk to Dolly about it, and the two of them agreed that when she died, she would free their slaves. As you said, though, she didn't do that. And the reason she didn't do it was she had a son she brought into the marriage when she married Madison, and he was a drunk and a gambler and just a wastrel. And so she ended up selling off slaves to pay off his debts, which I'm sure that Madison would have found entirely uncongenial. Whether he would have gone along with it is a different question, because he always was happy to write this kid a check, but it's not a happy outcome, and it's, as you say, it's not the one Madison hoped for.
I guess to wrap it up, obviously America, even today, has a great reverence for the Founding Fathers, constantly talking about them, thinking on a day-to-day basis, what would the Founding Fathers think of us doing this or that? If Madison were alive today to see this, how do you think, in your studies, he would feel about this? Would he be proud? Would he be terrified?
Well, that's a good question. His central commitment was to the idea of popular government. So that's one thing. We have had a republic that's lasted this long, I mean, in some sense. On the other hand, he thought written constitutions should be read the way the people had understood them when they adopted them. That was always his hermeneutical approach to constitutional interpretation. And clearly, we don't have anything like that now. The idea that the Constitution should be understood as the people intended it to be understood when they adopted it is seen as a kind of antediluvian position. You know, you'd only take that if you were a Cro-Magnon man. That's not cool and trendy. So for a Madisonian, contemporary American constitutionalism is entirely foreign. And if it were possible to transfer people from their own times to other times and Madison could come here, I think he'd find that shocking and unhappy. Maybe probably another thing, though, that would be striking is that it's become a multiracial society, and we've tried to ensure that people of different races have the same rights. This is something that he thought was impossible, although he favored the idea in the abstract and certainly thought that blacks, whose situation was the issue he was considering, should have the same rights. He didn't think that was possible in the U.S., and so at the end of his life, he worked for years to find them somewhere else to live.
Liberia, I believe it was.
Well, his friend James Monroe did help to establish the West African country of Liberia, but Madison didn't really put his finger on that. He just thought that some place ought to be found, and because everybody was entitled to self-government, everybody was entitled to various freedoms we consider natural, but he thought, like his friend Jefferson, that white people would never accept black people as equals, and so they had to be sent somewhere else. I think he'd find it shocking and probably happy that we've made an effort to do this.
The book is James Madison and the Making of America. Kevin, thanks again for being on the show, and best of luck to you going forward.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
Yes, have a good one. Thank you.